Here at Radio Bio, we have a pretty diverse group of backgrounds. A lot of conversations this season have been about using innovative techniques in fields like genetics to understand various phenomena at what we call the basic research level. These are studies that use very high-resolution, controlled experiments to look at mechanisms behind certain processes that we observe in nature. Some scientists would say we've entered kind of a golden age in biology. The area of high-throughput sequencing and big data in genomics has allowed us to study things like speciation in both modern and deep time frames. But sometimes we're left with a few big questions.
How do landscapes influence the distribution of genes in populations? How can we best study the speciation process? We go back with Dr. Jack Seitz to the early days of gene sequencing and phylogenetics. Then we go way back in evolutionary time and talk about his quest to understand the deep evolutionary relationships among scaly creatures, the reptiles.
Dr. Seitz also will then talk about why combining some of the new techniques available to us can be a huge boon for conservation, because if it has a name, it can be protected.
This is Radio Bio. Hello and welcome to Radio Bio. I'm Kinsey Brock.
And I'm Jeff Lauder.
Today, we're joined by Dr. Jack Seitz, Jr. He is the Mazur Professor of Biology at Brigham Young University, has recently been the president of the Society of Systematic Biologists, and has published over 150 peer-reviewed papers in top evolutionary biology journals. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Seitz.
Pleasure.
So can you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are, an introduction to what you study?
First day of college, biology was a declared major. I was never in any doubt about that. 4-year degree, had some natural history oriented classes, and I had 2 summers of work experience as a seasonal naturalist for the state park system of Tennessee. I spent 1 summer in West Tennessee and another summer in East Tennessee, and I learned. Basically, I was paid to lead hikes, give campfire talks, and when I wasn't doing those 2 things, the state provided 35-millimeter color film back then. There was no digital. And I roamed around the woods and waded creeks and day and night and trying to find stuff and photograph it and construct new hiking trails with numbered stops, and this is a shagbark hickory, no Latin names, but a little self-guided pamphlet that somebody could pick up and walk a 1-mile circle loop with 30 plants labeled. So this was my undergraduate background, wanting to be a biologist but not quite knowing at that age exactly what you could do, except I knew there were full-time naturalists in the state and the national park system. So I kind of had that in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do an ecology project because I wanted something that would keep me outdoors, and I thought that was the only discipline that would do that. My initial approach to the man that would be my advisor was to study salamander food habits. I was naive about hypotheses and those kind of things. And he said, that's epistemological natural history. I didn't know. I had to go look that word up. It was descriptive science. It wasn't hypothesis driven. And I was stumped about that. Oh, well, okay, how do you do hypothesis driven science? And he gave me some papers by an ecologist named Thomas Schoner, who had developed foraging strategy theory. And first 1 or 2 papers to me looked like solid math. I thought, if this is what it takes to develop a hypothesis, I'm toast. I can't do this. So I went back to him, and then he said, oh, skip all the math. Just look at what his arguments are. Well, why didn't you tell me that in the beginning? So I did. Then I began to tease it out. If a predator can roam around, that predator can be choosy. It can select the best prey and not waste time chasing down marginal prey that don't provide enough calories. On the other hand, if it's restricted, it can't be choosy. And so my advisor was leading me along, okay, now think about a salamander that lives along a stream bank. In the spring of the year, there's a lot of rain. They can move around. In the late summer, they're probably stuck under their rock or within a meter. Yeah, that makes sense. They would be selective here, not so choosy at this time of year. And that all looked good. And then I was communicating by letter back then, no email. This was 1974, with a salamander, a PhD student at the University of Maryland, who took a deep interest in my project. And he provided a lot of the details. He said, now, remember, you got to sample the prey. And I thought, oh, man, this is deciduous forest leaf litter. So I went and talked to an entomologist about sampling and separating bags of leaf litter in Berlazy funnels with a vial of ethanol, and you catch every little thing that drops out of there. And then, yeah, it's unbeatable. I ended up spending 90% of my time at a microscope measuring these tiny little things. That it was pretty fascinating, actually.
And so you completed your master's project that was very heavy on the field work, being outside and quantifying different aspects of salamander ecology. What was next for you?
Got the thesis. At the time, my advisor and the other faculty, there was no emphasis on publishing. I thought, I'm done. I've got a master's degree. Mm-hmm. And immediately after that, I got hired by the Nature Conservancy. This was September 1975. When they were just setting up what back then were called heritage programs, and Tennessee was about the fifth state. They had started, the South Carolina was first in 1974. The goal here, in today's terms, it was to build a biodiversity database state by state.
For our listeners who may not be familiar, biodiversity databases are essentially like libraries of life for biologists. You could go online and search a biodiversity database for information on where a species exists to identify other areas of suitable habitat.
You couldn't do everything, and so the Conservancy was interested in anything that was federally listed, threatened or endangered. So for the state of Tennessee, we got everything federally listed, anything state listed. Anything that might not be listed but peripheral, if something was restricted to the extreme northeast corner or southwest corner of Tennessee, Conservancy wanted it in the database. Mm-hmm. Special habitats like bird roosting rookeries, bat hibernacula, mm-hmm. High elevation plant communities called balls mm-hmm. that you find in the Appalachians, those sorts of things. So we bought a.
So you personally worked on all these different.
No. I was the vertebrate zoologist. They hired an animal ecologist, a plant ecologist, a plant taxonomist, mm-hmm. a secretary, a director, and a computer programmer. This was typing on cards, feeding them into computers. Well, that was this. This was 1974, and we had. An African-American computer programmer, a woman secretary, a woman animal ecologist. This was Tennessee, and we were fairly diverse. Yeah. We thought we're ahead of the game and
nice.
The kind of people we brought in. So the other thing we did, we bought a set of quad topo maps for the whole state and outlined in different color national park units, mm-hmm. State park units, national wildlife refuge, state hunting areas, TVA reservoir areas, the Oak Ridge National Lab. That's 40,000 acres, Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Anything that had some level of protection. Mm-hmm. Different colors. If it's strict protection like national parks, if it's places that allow hunting. So we started putting dots on the map for. We went to the literature. We visited museum collections, talked to curators. Most were happy to share their data. So I was doing the amphibians and reptiles, some of the mammals. Well, I was doing all the vertebrates, okay? Putting dots on the maps, what was already protected, what was not. We spent a year doing that. This is all on NatureServe now, if you know that big website. Mm-hmm. And it was very rewarding. I felt like we're contributing to an organization that has the resources to identify and protect these places based on science, yeah, based on what's left out of the system.
Mm-hmm. So how did you make the transition from practitioner to research in academia?
I think I could have made that a career, but in the course of doing that, I met high-profile curators and researchers at the University of Tennessee and thinking, I think I want to do what that guy does for a living.
Mm-hmm. So were you hired to be a biological systematist?
Well, I was hired as a vertebrate zoologist. My first teaching assignment was human anatomy, and I tried my best, but that, to me, that course was a sophisticated, the wrist bone is connected to the elbow, and it was that, you just, it's, I call it my single species course. Yeah. And I developed a career following up the dissertation work on these chromosome races of Scaloperus gramicus in Mexico. Nobody in the department had ever written an NSF grant when I started. Wow. So I called program officers. You did everything by mail or phone, got some general advice, wrote a 3-year grant, first time got flushed. Got the reviews back in the mail, read them all, rewrote it, sent it in again, flushed again. I'm losing a year each time.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to the program officers, and they're trying to be helpful. And the third time around, taking after 2 years of critique, sent it back in 3 years. They funded it for two for cytogenetics work. The total grant was $59,000. I thought this was the pot of gold. And I had grant money for the first time. It's a type of systematics that's more population focused. We were addressing evolutionary questions. When I finished it, I submitted a renewal, an extension of the same thing, got torpedoed, and they say, no, you really need to add something new to this. But I'm learning each time.
Yeah.
I took a short-term leave in 1986 to Alan Templeton's lab, learned restriction mapping, mm-hmm. and we did restriction digest on a fragment of mitochondrial DNA and on the nuclear rDNA repeat. So I had a nuclear gene the next time I resubmitted. And on the cytogenetic side, a former colleague at A&M had developed or incorporated a fine-scale methodology to look at chromosome pairing with transmission electron microscopy in an early part of the interphase when in the light microscope you don't see anything. Mm-hmm. We put all this into an NSF grant, bang, first time, 3 years of funding, $180,000. I thought this was I was in space, you know, in orbit about this. And we got some good papers out of that. Anyway, to make a long story short, I learned by trial and error how to write grants, and you have to have a new twist, a new data set.
Well, so systematics are what you have been talking about, the kind of work that, you eventually became a master of, is the study of relationship among organisms, and in your specific case, squamates are, mostly lizards.
And mostly shallow history, recent divergences, relatively speaking.
Right, and so your field has evolved rapidly with advances in technology like high-throughput sequencing, next-gen sequencing, whatever you want to call it, even in just the past five to ten years. So, you've been telling us about what it was like in the 70s and 80s. How are those first studies comparing to what you're able to do now?
There is no comparison. No. Everything we took a couple of years to do could be done in 3 or 4 days now.
Yeah.
On more numbers of animals.
Right.
Yeah.
It's hard to
Hard to fathom. I was granted the freedom for two long-term leaves. I went back to Texas to learn manual DNA sequencing in acrylamide gels. Mm-hmm. Label with P32, you're standing behind plexiglass loading these hot gels, developing auto rads and with a keyboard AAGC. Yeah. It took a year to get 1200 bases for 10 animals.
Now we're getting
I've seen the whole range of development.
Some of what you presented today was about how molecular methods might not be potentially as useful unless they're paired with other methods to potentially identify speciation events. But on top of that, you also went into a little bit of a discussion of the conservation value of identifying species using some of these methods.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you think that giving a species a name or actually delineating those isolation events in general is more useful for conservation than treating species as kind of a continuum, let's say?
Really good question. In a lot of Latin countries have followed our lead in passing endangered species legislation. In the United States, our ESA, Endangered Species Act, for vertebrates allows for protection of genetically distinct populations. They don't have to have a name. That's not the case in most Latin countries, maybe not any of them. I'm not sure. We don't want to name something that's not a valid species, but our colleagues there, they drill down real hard on multiple lines of evidence, because if there's something small or only on one mountaintop and it really is valid, and they can document it with multiple lines of evidence, that becomes high priority for them. They've all got endangered species programs that operate with different levels of success, but if something has a name, then by law, it's the developers have to pay attention to it. That how well that works varies by country, and we can't do anything about the politics, but we can work really hard to make sure these things we name are supported by multiple lines of evidence. So I think in that sense, it makes a huge difference.
So how do you go about actually finding where these species are delineated, or even defining a species? So if you have evidence of a potential species, how do you then confirm it? What are your next steps?
What we do is identify what we call candidate species. We sample as much of the range as possible. It's got one Linnaean name. Well, there's a real well-defined mitochondrial haploclade here, or nested clade, several of these. And our papers, we call them candidate species. Okay, now we need to follow up and do the morphological, the different kinds of morphological data or data sets. And there are multiple ways to analyze that, distributional data and the bioclimatic variables that we can use to estimate a niche envelope.
Using kind of those multiple methods, you can get a more integrative idea.
Exactly. And Cesar Aguilar, the Peruvian student, has really, out of my group, he's really taken the lead on, he really likes that kind of thing.
So not to kind of put you on the hot seat here, mm-hmm. but I know there's still kind of a debate going on in terms of, do species even exist? How do we delineate them? What's your stance on that from your prior research?
I think they're real. There's always going to be hard cases. There's that gray zone in the Kevin DeKeyroz figure that shows up in every talk now, or most of them. That's the nature of speciation. It's not ever going to be black and white all the time. I think we're getting better at it. I think genomic data will help, but I think that we got to be careful how we use that. There are people better qualified to comment on that than I am. The best we can do is collect a lot of lines of evidence, and where they line up, where they coalesce and define the same thing, that's a well-confirmed species hypothesis. I think the key issue here is species are hypotheses like almost everything else.
And divergence between species isn't always discrete.
That's right. It's continuous. There's always going to be a gray zone.
So you didn't talk much about in your seminar talk today about the Deep Scaly project, and I'd like to talk about that a bit. So this work seeks to develop novel single-copy protein-coding nuclear genes to test the deep evolutionary relationships among squamates.
Right.
So what motivated you to take on this project?
I was invited into that one.
Okay.
So John Weens and Todd Reeder led out on that. We had Maureen Kearney at the Field Museum, who's world-class morphologist, Jacques Gauthier at Yale, a paleontologist. The goal here, and back then, 50 nuclear genes was a lot. It was a big data set. This went through on the first review.
In what year? Early time.
Probably. Early 90s. No, wait a minute. We're in two...
I think it's 2017.
mid-90s, I would guess.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been done. It was 5 years. We met annually at the Field Museum. We brought how are we doing? My part with the Reeder lab and a little bit of the Weens lab was to generate a lot of these markers. Everybody was going to get about 17 nuclear genes. It was not to get all the species, or not even close. It was to get representatives of all of the families mm-hmm. of squamates, two or three species for each one, to get the deep history, mm-hmm. the fossils, the external and internal morphology. That was Maureen Kearney's part of the work, Jacques Gauthier, all the fossils, and integrate this into a phylogeny with not a huge number of tips, maybe 50 or 60, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But at the time, that was the most synthetic approach to the deep phylogeny of squamates, which was controversial. And at the same time, it didn't conflict with programs around the world where this student was going to do this genus or this. We weren't interested in that at all.
So just curious, with that phylogeny that was created, how does it hold up today?
A good question. I don't know that. Of course, we can get a lot more markers now, right, quicker yeah. for a lot less money. There still is a conflict between the morphology and the molecular. And once we published all this, there were a couple of little short articles in Systematic Biology, even one in Science, Dave Hillis, Jonathan Losos, several years ago. I don't really care, except that it points out a really interesting question, because there's right. good support from different data sets. It's just a couple of clades deep in the tree. But I think what it's telling us, there's something very, very interesting going on here, and we're not sure what it is.
Who named it the Deep Scaly Project?
Either Weens or Reeder. They wanted a catchy, sexy term, you know. Yeah, it's you think about it, that's pretty cool. I'm not creative enough to come up with these things like this.
So earlier you talked a little about morphological data and collecting mm-hmm. that data to fill in some of the gaps and mm-hmm. Some of the molecular data. Arguably, that's one of the coolest parts about being a field ecologist, is getting to go to these cool, far-off places. Some of the places that you've talked about working in the western U.S., Appalachian Mountains, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, French Guiana, the list goes on. So what are some of your favorite field sites, like some of your favorite memories of some of those field expeditions?
Oh, wow. a lot of it from Mexico. Not knowing any Spanish in the beginning, Joanne and I had to buy out of pocket a pickup truck used with no air conditioning, the cheapest we could get. Mm-hmm. We camped everywhere. You dysentery, you know, thing. You just have to buck through all of that. It's no fun sometimes. I think overall, it's a really hard question you just asked. Every place has its charms and its challenges.
I was going to say, it's so interesting to me that we ask you what your favorite place is and you bring up all the challenges first, and that's what you loved about it.
Yeah, and I think some of the best science I have ever done was on that complex mm-hmm. because we stayed with it so long. We got some grant support using the best tools available at the time, and dense sampling, finding hybrid zones and working across those, doing mark recapture to get estimates of dispersal. The first time I went to Brazil, I was there 2 months. It was more than I could absorb. It was so massive, flying across part of the western Amazon, 350 air miles, unbroken canopy, no sign of tiny little clearings by Aboriginal people who have not had any contact. I mean, they see planes, but there's no contact. You're just sort of dumbfounded that this is still available in the 21st century. That southern Andes of Chile, the Valdivian forest there, jaw-dropping scenery. The Pampas of Argentina and Patagonia. For a kid growing up in rural Tennessee, this is beyond words. I don't know how. I never imagined this would happen. Yeah, we are, all of us.
So as somebody who's helped shape the field of herpetology, what do you think are the big burning questions of our generation?
Still the deep, scaly questions. Mm-hmm. Okay. At the shallower level where I'm much more comfortable, still speciation, the details, how populations diverge, the tools your generation has access to, not just in genomics, but transcriptomics, how certain genes are expressed in vision or senses. All of that's got to be relevant. The colors that males can perceive in other males, or what some of Dan's students are doing. These are really challenging but exciting questions. You can do a lot in the field. You can take photographs that I couldn't and quantify color patterns in a way we couldn't do.
Yeah.
That all of these are relevant. And so part of me – envy is not the right word. I'm excited. I'm excited. Yeah. I cannot keep up with it.
It's kind of a good segue into a different interpretation of that question. If you can put on your prophecy hat, what do you think are some kind of big advancements or questions that could be answered in the near future in the fields of herpetology and systematics?
The population divergence questions. I can't think of anything. Natural selection, sexual selection, there are demographic issues, yes. There's genetic issues, there's vision, color, territoriality, behavior. I think that can now be integrated in ways we couldn't imagine. Even 5 years ago was a long time ago now. So good luck.
I love that answer. It's what I'm doing for my dissertation.
Yeah, but have fun with it. You got tools and methods that will take you a step or two further in getting at these questions, and you still get to go in the field and be 6 years old again, chasing frogs or butterfly, whatever it is. That's the part that never gets old.
So we've loved hearing kind of all about your path into science and into academia in general, and just kind of your story today. What would be your advice to a budding evolutionary biologist or ecologist or budding scientist in general?
The one thing I think that made it all work, if I had a new opportunity, I took it. Even if the details weren't worked out, I wasn't sure how it would turn out, and sometimes it didn't work, but do you remember the Robin Williams movie, The Dead Poets Society?
Yeah,
Carpe Diem.
Yeah.
Carpe Diem. if something comes up, jump on it. That's the best short answer I can give. I'll tell students, I have been paid for my hobby my whole career. That's as close as anybody can get what you aspire to. We get paid for our hobbies. That's a privilege.
Yeah.
Treat your colleagues nicely. You can disagree. Just do so in a spirit of shared advancement. Don't take anything personally. Life's too short, but have fun with it.
The disagreement drives scientific
advancement. Yeah. And most people are really nice. Mm-hmm. Work with the nice people. Avoid the pricks. There aren't many, but they're well known. It's not worth the trouble. That would have fun with it.
Well, Dr. Seitz, besides your amazing contribution to our collective knowledge of herpetology and phylogenetics, you've been an incredible mentor to many, and students in your lab have gone on to do really wonderful work around the world. And I know my advisor, Dr. Dan Edwards, admires you and thinks the world of you as a mentor. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us today and just share your words of wisdom, and thank you.
It's been a blast. Thanks.
This has been Radio Bio with Dr. Jack Seitz. Thanks for listening.
Good. This was cool.
Radio Bio is supported by the Quantitative and Systems Biology Graduate Group at the University of California, Merced.